We begin things this hour by welcoming into the program writer Colin Fleming, the author of the brand spanking new and delightfully awesome book, Meatheads Say the Realest Things, a satirical short novel of the last bro. Hello, Colin.
Rich, don't call me Kimbalicious Kimball. How are you, sir?
Well, I'm Kimbalicious today. Yes, indeed, sir. Yes. I see you've incorporated more into your workout. What kind of madness are you doing now, Colin?
I am compensating for the closure of the Bunker Hill Monument by running hill sprints outside the Bunker Hill Monument. So as my sister tartly observed, you're keeping the monument in view. So yes, but when that finally reopens in like 2024, if I'm still around. And so I walk epic distances, as you know. I run stairs, but to run the stairs, I have to walk 10 miles to get to them. That's how rare 100-plus stairs are in a single go. And then I do my runs, but I'm rubbish at that. So now I'm also doing these hill sprints. And I'll say this, my friend, hill sprints are not a good time. They will humble you awfully swiftly.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, there's some burning that goes on, I'm guessing.
It's funny. Like, you do so much exercise that I do, you'd think that, like, you're employing every muscle and you're all set. But you just start running up a hill, sprinting up a hill, and you notice it, like, in the hamstrings. And it's like, why didn't the stairs take care of that? Like, what's going on with the stairs here? Do I need to do, like, everything, just overlay all my different crazy workouts? But I don't want that Reaper coming for me, and I have a lot of stress, so this is what I do.
All right, well, I got a lot of stress after watching the film you recommended that we're going to talk about, a BBC film from the early 1970s that, man, that thing was about seven different kinds of creepy, but it was terrific. The Stone Tape, featuring, of course, Paul McCartney's ex-girlfriend, Jane Asher, who I don't think I had seen her in much before, but she was perfect in that part.
Yes, Jane Asher. She is, you'd think, too, that she'd be, like, pretty ubiquitous, that you would have seen her in so many things. But I think a lot of the things that she were in were pieces sort of consigned to their day that haven't lived on in some ways, whereas this one, being a BBC British horror production of the 1970s, I think, like, that's popular among a certain generation. There's the nostalgia factor, but you're not just really getting the nostalgia factor, because a lot of people, especially in America, would be coming to these films for the first time, and so they provide quite a low budget jolt in an economical fashion. Another one is Children of the Stones, which is perhaps even creepier because it involves children. But this is a great one, and it's a great one for now, in that you have these scientists are trying to find a new way to preserve sound, to find something better than tape. So it's sort of like a proto-digital type of deal. And they end up in this old house locating a kind of ghost that starts showing up first on film and then within the computer. So it's actually about really a haunted computer. So take that, 2021.
Yeah, this whole idea of residual haunting that's been used, well, a lot since then, I would say certainly Spielberg inspired and took some of those ideas for Poltergeist.
And it was always used before that. You'll find it in Victorian and Edwardian ghost stories. You'll find it in all kinds of different spectral texts going back through the centuries. Because I think, I don't know, if you're not keen to believe in, like, oh, I saw a ghost, you perhaps are more keen to believe in the idea of this leftover energy, let's call it. And that's what this is about. But it's also in another way. It's about a quite real ghost. And it's about not just a real ghost, it's about how easy it is to become a ghost. And I think that throws into relief for us kind of the nature of what horror really is, because we think of horror as something under the bed and bogeymen and the creatures of the crypt and whatnot, but there's also that very real diurnal haunting. And I think that's what makes this teleplay so fitting right now, when we have so many people haunted by the specter of themselves that's not a reality-based entity that they try to put forward on social media via the computer. And this is very much about being haunted by way of your screen And there's that like line that is kind of lived on as semi-famous, like, it's in the computer. And I'm thinking like, yeah, it is in the computer, yeah. Boyo. You got that damn straight.
Yeah, and you know, to me, the unseen is always much more frightening than whatever we can see in a film or in a television show. And that's so strong in this. But I also love the pace of this, too, that just seems to add to the tension.
The unseen is potent and also what we don't expect to see. One of the most chilling moments in all of Dracula, when, like, the letter writer who's traveled to the Count's castle realizes he's in for a bad time, is when he realizes that Dracula doesn't have staff, and he sees him making his bed, like, in the morning, and he thinks, uh-oh, something is really awry here. It's just some guy making a bed. But for this particular narrator, it's the very codification of terror. So I think that's something that's done well in these BBC productions, in part because the BBC wasn't going to throw lots of money at a lavish setup. And that's always how the BBC had been. We have so many of those, talk about like the BBC with sound, so many sessions by various British bands were wiped, and the first beginnings of Doctor Who were famously white. So you're having to make a lot out of imagination. But I think that's really where the best horror comes from. You see it, for instance, in Val Luden's films. They're not like high-budget affairs, but they're like a 1940s version without the technology of these BBC productions of the 1970s.
Yeah, somebody unencumbered by special effects.
But I always, when special effects come on the screen, for the most part, they're like wedding scenes and sex scenes. It's just something for me to get through. I always want to say, okay, movie, let's get back to it. Pick up the pace here. Because they're just meant to be a digression. You can have a special effects scene that goes on for 2 minutes, and the movie would be the exact same thing if it went on for 35 seconds. So when you have that sort of component, that it doesn't matter the length of time, it says to me, why have it at all? That's ineffective. That's just kind of this sideshow. And I don't want sideshow. I like to be moving forward. That doesn't mean like you're barreling along at the same rapid pace the entire time, but you need to be moving the audience forward. And I think that's something that the Stone Tape does reasonably well.
Well, you can find it on YouTube, and it is some terrific stuff. The Stone Tape from, I think, 1972. We're talking with Colin Fleming on Four Little Beatles. And Can't Buy Me Love, one of those songs that everybody knows from 1964, but the version that we all know was not the original version.
No, the version that we know would be at loggerheads with the initial, one of the early attempts at the song. And I've come around to thinking that the Beatles were never better than they were by 1964. And that's not to slag off the albums that came after that, because they're special. But I think the most emblematic Beatles recordings are the early recordings. I think there's a spirit there and an energy that you don't really find anywhere else in any form of popular music. So they're in Paris, and they've not come to the States yet. This is January 1964, but they've conquered England, and people are screaming at their concerts, all of that stuff. But they don't go over that well in Paris. They'll return to Paris in June 1965, and they'll perform their only encore of their fame years, as a kind of stick it to the audience, see, we are pretty good kind of deal. But they try in a Parisian studio to record Can't Buy Me Love, and usually it's summarized as a rhythm and blues affair, which isn't what the actual album track and subsequent single was. But to me, it's country and western. It's very Carl Perkins. And I think Carl Perkins is sort of the secret influence of the early Beatles, more so than, oh, probably anyone else, in terms of the guitar tone and that loping approach to beat. And this certainly has that lope to it. And they're using background vocals because they didn't know like that they could sort of go along without backing vocals. And they're going to jettison those here, the Lennon and Harrison vocals. And they're still figuring out. It's like a great song, but it wouldn't have been a hit. It would have been like a really quirky album number if they hadn't altered it significantly.
And it was George Martin, I understand, who really suggested restructuring the lyrics and basically opening the song with a chorus.
Yeah, and they did that on She Loves You as well. And that just was something that wasn't really done at the time, because this sort of writing that the Beatles were doing, the Beatles wouldn't have known this themselves necessarily, but it was based out of Tin Pan Alley. And Tin Pan Alley songs have a fairly rigorous structuring to them. So they're listening to Elvis, but Elvis's songs are being written by Tin Pan Alley tunesmiths. And so that's how you're learning. You're not so much aping the people that came before you, but that's your blueprint, and you're adding on to it what you add on to it. So it was very freeing when someone like Martin could say, look, you don't have to do it this way, or you don't have to have like this set number of bars for this particular section, or whatever it was. And Can't Buy Me Love is one of the early instances. And from the chorus, right from the start, and the finished version, it plays that song, because it begins with that full-throated shout, it plays at a volume that appears to be greater than it actually is, if that makes sense. Mm-hmm. By the time you get to the guitar solo of that song, it'll tear your head off. It is so loud. But like, if you just measured it like decibel-wise, it's not really that different from Tell Me Why or any of its surroundings. But it's set up by that full-throated shout of how they figured out that the song should begin.
We are in Baseball Hall of Fame season. The ballots are in the hands of voters right now, and an interesting class of newcomers and some hangers-on hoping to finally get their due at Cooperstown. What do you think of this year's ballot and the people that you'd like to see in the Hall of Fame?
I'm someone who, I don't think this is very serious. I think people turn it into something that it isn't, for reasons that are commonly more endemic to who they are and what I would term their shortcomings. The very notion of a Hall of Fame, like, it sounds silly, doesn't it? Like, it doesn't sound like an adult concept. It sounds like cartooning, almost, like the Hall of Fame, like the Legion of Justice. It's like, all right. So I like when lots of people get into Halls of Fame. I don't think that they should be this kind of, like, only Willie Mays and Hank Aaron and Ty Cobb or Gretzky and Gordie Howe and Bobby Orr or whatnot. I like when players who are close get in, because a lot of it is hair splitting, and the notion of a morals clause is something that I find rather hypocritical and disturbing and inauthentic, and also often about a kind of grandstanding, because these were young, virile men in, well, even before the prime of life, on the road with lots of money, or what was seen as a lot of money, if it's the 1950s or whatever, living lives that I don't think were so great in many ways. If people know something about Mickey Mantle, they'd be well-versed in sort of the damage that he did to the people who cared about him. And yet no one ever says, oh, Mickey Mantle shouldn't be in. So I throw all of that out. I think it could be a shutout this year. Curt Schilling should have been in a long time ago, regardless of how one feels about him. And Barnes and Clemens, it's silly that they're not in. And even someone like Manny Ramirez, who is maybe not at that Barry Bonds level, but if you watched him, you knew he was one of the best right-handed batters who ever lived. And I think that cements that you should be in this particular assembly.
I think there are, to my mind, there are two halls of fame. There's the one that exists in Cooperstown that baseball fans can go to and walk around and look at the plaques. And I think most of the people who are there want to see more people honored, want to see the greatest in the game based solely on what they did on the field. And then there is this ethereal Hall of Fame that the Baseball Writers Association has in their minds that holds people to very different standards. And quite often that standard is, how did they treat members of our profession?
That latter point is the key point, because biographically, it suggests to me there is a complete dearth of expertise in our world right now, to the point that expertise is often villainized. And I knew basic things about some of these ball players when I was 10, 11, 12 years old, because I read a lot. And you're like almost ranking sins and posting something on Twitter about a bathroom does not compare to humping 238 women who weren't your wife and hurting your kids. It doesn't. It's not comparable. And we don't want to be in the conscientious position of determining these moral absolute, because it's just not, you're not going, then you might as well avoid the entire Hall of Fame. And I think the Hall of Fame is cool, all the sports, because it allows you to have a relationship with the player that you like after their playing time is over, and it keeps up your interest in maybe players like them, the sport. It's just a nice thing to have as an attachment. Now, I've been to the Baseball Hall of Fame once when I was a kid, but I would wager that most people who are really into the Baseball Hall of Fame and who gets in, they probably don't go. I don't think they have, like, 17 million people there in this tiny New York town every year. I think the discussions are good. Like, last year, you kind of had me, for instance, convinced on Todd Helton. Now I'm looking at his numbers again, and I'm seeing a guy who had only 369 home runs as the first baseman, with almost 100 of them coming in 2 years, who only cracks the top 10 in MVP voting three times. That's a little light for me.
Well, and I find myself, and I guess it's recency bias or something like that, looking at guys like Scott Rolen, like Bobby Abreu is the classic one to me, even a Gary Sheffield, and in my mind, I think of them as being very good players from not all that long ago, and it's hard for me to think of them in the same breath as the Mays, the Mantles, the Aarons, even the Yastrzemskis of the world, and I realize that's just because I'm old and I've been watching the game for a long time.
Oh, they're the Alan Trammells of the world and the Rabbit Marinvilles of the world, and players like that, the Rick Ferrells of the world, a catcher with the Red Sox in the 30s, who were like very sort of borderline, but I never begrudged them. Like, for instance, we both like Dwight Evans, and you think he should be in, and I don't think he should be in because he didn't have a plus season until he was 29 years old, and that's just too much of your career not to be like a B+, A-minus, A type of player. And then when he starts having his run of seasons, he doesn't have a solid, like, really good season every year. Like, in 1985, he's pretty bad. And you can't afford to be bad when you've started being good so late. But if Dwight Evans got in, that's cool to me, because I like Dwight Evans. Like, I enjoyed watching him as a player. And I never think, unless it's costing someone else, I never think, well, this just denigrates the Hall of Fame. It cheapened it. Like, no, it doesn't. We all know that Ted Williams was better than Ron Santo. Like, Roland will eventually get in because there aren't that many third basemen under represented position. But you have to put Ken Boyer in, I feel like, before you put Scott Rolen in. And I don't hear his name. I know he's not on the ballot right now, but the player who was a better hitter than Brooks Robinson, who wasn't that much weaker as a fielder. And to me, he's like a rich man, Scott Rolen. But yeah, Rolen, there needs to be more third basemen and more catchers. The numbers for catchers look higher in a sense, because early on in the Hall of Fame, catchers were valued so, like, massively.
Yes.
Some guys got in who probably maybe shouldn't have gotten in, but now you leave out, like, a Bill Freehan or whomever.
I love Bill Freehan. You know that. That's why you said that name, just to get me going.
Bill Freehan's problem was that he reached his prime in the late 1960s. Like, if you look at Carl Yastrzemski, you mentioned, look at the year he had in 1968. He hits 301. He's the only player in the American League. He hit 300. Look at his war. He's almost at the level he is in 1967 when he had one of the all-time seasons. But across the board, if you just look at his raw numbers, they're nothing. They're kind of meaningless, right? They're really pedestrian. And yet, when you look at them within the era of that particular pitcher season, you're like, wow, this is one of the best years that somebody has ever had. And Bill Freehan's career was sort of in that pocket. He played for a while, of course, but his career was in that pocket of time. So when he's a catcher with 20 home runs and 74 RBI, you don't really like, oh, wow, he's Mike Piazza. But he was kind of like mini Mike Piazza with way better defense at the time.
Colin Fleming with us here on Downtown. We move from the Baseball Hall of Fame, as only we can on this segment, to the Stooges and a live concert recorded at Goose Lake in August of 1970. And I didn't know much about Goose Lake and what a huge and oftentimes out of control gathering this was.
You, my friend, imagine if you could teleport yourself back there now, the roué that you are, the lascivious time a fellow like you would have. Wow, you'd be like the Earl of Rochester, of goose-like. it was a big festival. I mean, this was the era of the big festival, but it sounds strange, right? There was like 200,000 people or something at this festival, and the Stooges, with their original lineup, had just wrapped up a few months before recording Funhouse. And if you haven't checked out those like complete sessions, you should do that on Amazon. It's probably on Spotify too, where they're live in the studio and they're just doing like 17 takes in a row. And it's pretty amazing. So this was like their breakthrough moment. And it's the only soundboard surviving tape we have of the original lineup. And there are all these legends about this show over the years. Like the bassist is so combo of high and drunk out of his mind that his amp isn't plugged in, and which isn't true. And they squandered this moment, really. And this show has had this reputation of being like pretty terrible, but it's not terrible at all. Like, it's a great, raw, nice sounding rock and roll document that I think right away goes to the short list of like live albums you need to hear. It sounds almost too good to be true. It was discovered like in the basement of like a Michigan farmhouse. What was it doing there? I mean, it's just, you're like in the root cellar. That's a strange place for this to be. And it came out, and Jack White's record label put it out. And it is just some of the most frenetic rock and roll you'll ever hear.
And at the risk of losing, well, whatever street cred I don't have anyway, I've never been a big fan of the Stooges. That's just not my thing. But watching this, man, the incredible power and charisma of Iggy, it's there. And I still don't like him all that much, but I get it a lot more after watching him in action, fronting that group with an energy that you just don't see.
Now, I would have thought the Stooges would have been right up your street. You're a man who likes Husker Du. Now, it's kind of like a very slowed-down version of the Stooges. But the Stooges had sort of two incarnations. They had the first two albums, and then like they resume a few years later with a different lineup. What is it about them that you don't like that much?
I'm not a real big fan of hard rock. I'm more of a melody guy. I have very pedestrian pop sensibilities.
Is that why you're always Facebook messaging me at night saying, Colin, you need to hear this bootleg by Bread? I'm like, Kimball, what is it with you and Bread? Maybe I want you. I don't need like the demo of that. I don't need this. So, yeah, I mean.
Yeah, Colin, I'm always I'm begging you for obscure sides from Air Supply that you might know about.
Okay, this makes sense now. So, like, when I'm slagging off Christopher Cross and coming on and talking about Sailing Ironically, and you're all like, doesn't need to be ironic. That's canonical art. I'm thinking like Kimball. Like everyone has this sort of like weird one preference thing they get. I sort of like forgive that. But now it's starting to click into place for my man up there in Maine. That's why they call you Kimballicious.
I'm not proud of it, but I don't run from who I am.
You like Husker Du?
I do. And I don't, and I like Husker Du because I was exposed to them through the back door by a cover by Marshall Crenshaw. And then I went to listen to more of their music and went, wow, now this would not normally be my thing, but these guys are good. But they also had some great lyrical content, and I'm also one of those people who I like good lyrics.
Yeah, I was shocked when I completely changed my take on you when you said that you were into, like, you know, it was a few years ago that Husker Du, like, box set of rarities came out. You're like, I have to chase that down. And I thought, huh, I did not know that about this guy. So I figured when I mentioned this one to you, you would be all about the Stooges. But now I feel bad, man. My bad.
No, but you've brought me a little closer to that point. I've got a newfound respect for them because of you, which is what you do every week. You broaden my horizons, my friend.
Well, Ron Ashton, the guitarist for the Stooges, like it's very much in like a rhythmic 1950s vein, right? Like you hear the beginning of most of these songs, like that grinding, churning kind of Five Royales, even guitar. I think it's just, it harkens back to that. Yes, it's hard rock, but Eddie Cochran could be hard rock too, right?
Oh, yeah.
Think about it. So I think it's in that spirit of that Eddie Cochran type guitar groove.
Colin Fleming, every Tuesday here on Damned If you haven't done it yet, get your hands on his newest book, Meatheads Say the Realest Thing, a satirical short novel of the last bro. And look for more from Colin Cumming soon. Go to his website, colinflemminglit.com. For God's sake, subscribe to the blog, Many Moments More. Follow him on Twitter like all the cool kids do. Colin, we thank you as always. We'll do it again next week.
Sounds good.